Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. You know, in challenging times, peacemaking can feel impossible. It's easy to focus on our differences. It's easy to get carried away by our own perspective without looking carefully enough at what the world looks like through the eyes of someone else. And our stories today say something about that. And first, a story from our friend Motoko, who lives in Massachusetts. It's the story of a gig, a trip Motoko took with a group of her storytelling friends to China. And the group visited a very small village that used to be at the crossroads of major trade routes in China, making the village a crossroads for stories from far and wide. For six centuries, the master storytellers of this little village had gathered stories, thousands of them, and were now passing their stories on to every school child that would listen. And in that village, Motoko came face to face with someone who had personal memories of warfare between his country, China, and Japan, the country of Motoko's heritage. With a limited ability to understand each other's language, could Motoko build a bridge of peace with someone who could see her as an enemy? Here's Motoko with a story called It Takes Two.
At the heart of our trip was a four-day visit to a small rural village called Ganzuan, about 3-hour bumpy bus ride south from the capital city of Beijing. We had a rotating schedule amongst us. So today, Group A would visit Mr. Gao's and Mrs. Xi's homes, and tomorrow, Group B would visit those homes while Group A would visit somebody else's homes. So we will come together, meet the master storytellers and their families, friends and neighbors, and swap stories and learn from each other. Except, of course, there was a snag. We found out pretty quickly that many villagers, especially the elders, only spoke their traditional local dialect. We had brought our own translators we hired in Beijing, young, fashion-conscious Chinese college graduates who spoke excellent English. But they threw their hands up in the air and declared they had no idea what the villagers were saying. So we had to scramble around trying to find another set of translators, people who could speak Mandarin and the local dialect. So our story swap went like this. The Chinese master storyteller will tell a story. The local translator repeated it in Mandarin. Then our Beijing translator would put it in English. When one of us, the American storytellers, told the story, the same process was repeated in reverse. We all worked really hard. The local translator who was helping my group was a diminutive, well-dressed lady in her 50s. Her name was Mrs. Ma. Now, Mrs. Ma, her name means horse. So you see, Chinese language is tonal. You might have heard of this. It's very difficult. It's almost like music. So a simple word like ma, M-A, you can pronounce it in many ways. You can say ma, like that, and that means mother. Or you can say ma, and that means linen. Or you can say ma, and that means horse. Or you can say ma, which means to yell at someone. Or you can just say ma, which means a question mark, like ni hao ma, that means how are you, okay? So if you're not careful, you end up calling your mother horse, or your horse mom. So Mrs. Ma was a librarian in a nearby city, and she did not speak any English. So I tried on my rudimentary Mandarin on her that I picked up in my college days. I could say, 我是日本人, I am Japanese. I could say, 我在住美国, I live in the United States. 我很喜欢中国的故事, I love Chinese stories. Now, that was all I could really say. And I had a really difficult time understanding what she was saying. But Mrs. Ma was very patient with my extremely limited vocabulary, and she acted even a little protective of me. I would call her Lao Tai Tai, which meant madam. So every day we would spend several hours in the village listening to folk tales. Most of them funny, some were hilarious, some of them were very earthly and scatological, and others somewhat obscure. Then we would go back to a hotel in a nearby city for dinner. But our second night there, some of my American tourmates told me that their group had visited this home of a master teller named Mr. Jin, who told war stories. They said Mr. Jin had been a prisoner of war, captured and tortured by Japanese army during World War II. In fact, the village of Gansuen itself was nearly decimated by the Japanese, they said. Now, of course, I knew about the invasion of China by the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II and the brutal battles that had taken place. I had learned about them in my high school history class. But my knowledge was neither deep nor personal. My family never talked about the war much. All I knew was that my mother's father was killed during the American bombing of Osaka, and both my parents, as children, nearly starved to death during and after the war. So when I heard about Mr. Jin, the feelings I had were all mixed up. Sadness, apprehension, guilt, curiosity, embarrassment. Our rotating schedule said that my group was to visit Mr. Jin's home on our last day at the village. So my group, led by Mrs. Ma and our Beijing translator, who called himself Kevin, went through the traditional stone gate. We were led through an attractive small courtyard into their living quarters, which was basically consisted of two parts, a very tiny kitchen and a large spacious bedroom, which also served as the living room. Several villagers were already there waiting for us, sitting on the edge of the big double bed. They gave us chairs to sit around the bed. So I looked for a man in a military uniform, but I did not see one. Then I noticed a man with gray hair and a well-tanned face, short and stocky. He was wearing a beige sweater that reminded me of Mr. Rogers. He was chatting with an old lady sitting next to him. Now, he was the only person in the room who looked older than my father, so I figured he was Mr. Jin. So I sat in the corner of the room, not quite sure what to expect. "Today I am going to tell you a true story that really happened," Mr. Jin started solemnly as we all settled down. Mrs. Ma and Kevin translated. Mr. Jin looked around the room, and our eyes met. Then Mr. Jin hesitated and asked something to Mrs. Ma. Mrs. Ma looked in my direction and answered quickly. Mr. Jin nodded and cleared his throat. "Actually, today I am going to tell you a different story, an old folk tale." Mrs. Ma nodded and smiled approvingly. Then I realized what was going on. Mrs. Ma had told Mr. Jin that I was from Japan, and Mr. Jin decided not to tell his war story, perhaps in order to spare my feelings? "Excuse me," I was surprised to hear myself say, loudly and perhaps a little rudely. "I am Japanese, but I want to hear your war stories. Please don't switch for me." Mr. Jin, Mrs. Ma, and even Kevin looked very surprised, but I could not back down now. "Please," I said, a little desperately, my cheeks burning hot. All right, Mr. Jin said finally. And in his quiet, unceremonious manner, he told us a very short story, which went like this. When I was a young man, the enemies came to this village. My friend and I hid in our cabbage patch. The enemies came after us. One enemy found my friend hiding under a big cabbage leaf. He tried to pull my friend out, and my friend bit his hand. The enemy screamed and hit my friend with his gun. I jumped out to save my friend, and we were both captured. Then they ran my friend over with a truck. Abruptly, he ended. After a moment, it was clear that he was not going to say anything else, so we politely applauded. Mr. Jin then went outside, and the gathering broke into clusters of small conversations. Kevin was trying to organize us into a group photo shoot. So I tore a blank page from my notebook and, consulting my pocket dictionary, quickly wrote, "Thank you for your story. War is wrong. I wish for us to be friends." Of course, in my atrocious Chinese, it may have read, "Thank you, story. Fighting is incorrect. I want friends for us." I signed my name in Chinese symbols. I went outside and found Mr. Jin smoking a cigarette in the courtyard. So I handed him my note. He read it, and a broad smile came over his face. He said, "Su Zi," pronouncing my name in Chinese. So I nodded. Then he started talking rapidly in an excited manner, gesturing wildly, and I had no idea what he was saying. But just in time, Mrs. Ma came to my rescue. She told him, well, I assume she told him, that I only knew a dozen words in Mandarin and could not be expected to converse like a normal human being. Mr. Jin seemed to understand. Then he did something completely unexpected. He went, "Ich, ni, san, shi, ich, ni, san, shi," as if he was marching, counting in Japanese. In a flash of insight, I understood what he was saying. He was sharing the only four words of Japanese that he knew, and which was how to count from one to four. And he had learned it in the prison camp as the Japanese soldiers made him march from one place to another. Mr. Jin was grinning ear to ear, quite pleased that we finally found the four words that we both understood. We looked at each other and knew that there was so much more that we wanted to say to each other, we needed to say, but there were simply no words for it. So I did the only thing I could do. I bowed deeply, Japanese style, to him. You see, Chinese people do not bow. They shake hands just like Americans. As I came up, Mr. Jin took both my hands and shook them firmly, roaring with hearty laughter. Mrs. Ma, quite relieved, looked at us from one to the other, and she said something, and even I understood what she was saying. She was saying, "Hang hao, zhen hao," very good, truly good.
That was Motoko with "It Takes Two." Now, listening to this story reminds me, strangely, of my grandfather, Gordon W. Pappas, my mom's dad, who was a prisoner of war in occupied France near the end of World War II. He was captured and threatened with death, but his life was spared when the German officer tasked with seeing to my grandfather's death and anxious to get out of the war with some of its spoils, in an act of desertion, pressed my grandfather and another prisoner into service to help pull a wagon of stolen goods as the officer tried to make his own escape from the war. Well, Grandpa wound up being turned over by that guy to an enormous group of prisoners and their German captors, marched along for a couple of months in an attempt to keep ahead of the Allies who were sweeping across France at the war's end. And, of course, who would eventually liberate my grandfather and all those prisoners. Grandpa's story is amazing, but it's not unique. World War II prisoners found themselves often in close and brutal proximity with the enemy. And there's another part of my grandfather's story that's not unique. In the 1970s, some 30 years after the war, he went back to Europe to retrace his steps as a soldier. He spent a lot of time there, and his journey put him again in proximity to some of the very people who had overseen his imprisonment. For example, he made a visit to the very German officer who had made him pull that wagon and then pawned him off to march as a prisoner so many decades earlier. And in that visit, there was no rancor, no enmity between him and the people he met again. There was even a sort of unusual camaraderie between them. They had all survived a horrible war. They had all seen friends and loved ones killed or otherwise impacted by the horrors of that war. And there was a kind of brotherhood between them that was unhindered by the fact that they had fought on opposite sides. It's like that for a lot of soldiers, a lot of folks who fought and were imprisoned in World War II. When the enmity was stripped away, the brotherhood remained. And I've often thought of my grandfather when I've been faced with a situation in which there might be a difficulty that puts me on a side opposite someone else as their rival or their opponent or their enemy. The experience of my grandfather makes me look across the table at the other person and wonder, outside the situation we're in, would we be friends? And I'm always surprised at how often the answer is yes. And it makes me feel ready to lay down the enmity and just get to the brotherhood. And that's where Motoko's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? Well, our next story comes from Antonio Rocha, who tells a story about a peacemaker in his life who taught him an important lesson. He calls the story My Monk. Here's Antonio.
When I was 5, we moved away from Miracema, my hometown, to the big city of Rio de Janeiro. Yes, it was actually across the bay from Rio, the city of Niterói. And my mom was quite upset that we had to move away from the countryside to the big city because out of the 5 children she had given birth to, I was the only one at age 5, that was going to be cooped up in an apartment, not in a house, not in the countryside, not being able to ride a bicycle, not being able to climb trees. And she always took me to my hometown. Yeah. And when I was old enough to ride the bus, there was always a friend that was the driver. You know, she would put me in the front seat, and I would go and spend vacation weeks at a time at her sister's house, and I would room with one of her children, my cousin, King. Yes, King was my cousin. He still is my cousin. José Henrique. José Henrique, 4 years older than I am. Oh, he would take me to fly kites. We'd bike together, would go to the creek, and there was a tree. I remember like it was yesterday. There was a tree that one of the boughs of the tree went over the creek and would climb onto that bough with our fishing lines and see the fish we're trying to catch from that vantage point. King was awesome. He taught me how to catch frogs. Whoa, I got one too! We had slingshots. We played marbles. We had fun. Free range fun. Bare feet running through the countryside. And then would go into his bedroom before bedtime. He'd lie on his twin bed. I would lie in the other twin bed and would talk about the things that had transpired during the day. Ah. What a fun time, spending time with King. That was his nickname. Once, a monk was walking with his apprentice, and the apprentice looked at his master and said, "Master, teach me the difference between heaven and hell." They disappeared, and all of a sudden, they were in this banquet, this beautiful banquet with beautiful people dressed in beautiful clothing, and the food looked delicious, but they were so sad looking. And upon close inspection, the apprentice noticed that their arms could not bend at the elbow. They could not bend at the elbow, and with their straight arms, they couldn't feed themselves. And they were starving without that food in front of them. They could not eat the food. They could not bend their elbows. Young man, that's hell. They disappeared. And all of a sudden, boom, they're at the same banquet, but not quite. Same people, same food, same table, same attire, same arms, straight out, unable to bend at the elbow. But they're all smiling. And upon close inspection, the apprentice noticed that instead of trying to feed themselves, they could reach to each other's plates and feed each other. That is heaven. And now, as a grown man, looking back at my childhood with King, I realized that King was showing me heaven with those beautiful adventures. And mind you, he did it with a severe motor handicap. King, when he was supposed to sit, he didn't sit. When he was supposed to crawl, he didn't crawl. When he was supposed to walk, he didn't walk. When he was supposed to talk, he didn't talk. He did all those things much later than the other children. But my aunt, his mother, Tia Maria, instead of holding him inside, she let him loose. And nature taught him how to run. Nature taught him how to climb trees, how to ride bicycles, how to fly kites, how to go fishing. King was an amazing kid. He played soccer. He grew into strength. Nobody messed around with him. He was a strong kid with a huge, kind heart. He had the soccer kick that people dove out of the way. You know, King. And then he went, "Junior, yeah, come, come." See, in Brazil, I'm called Junior because I have my dad's name, Junior. Junior, I want to show you something. And King takes me to this place. It's dark. It's after sunset. We had been out and about, seeing heaven all day long. And he takes me inside this building with zinc rooftop. And we have to kind of go underground. And there are a lot of people there. And they're talking and screaming. And I'm behind them. You know, we're not supposed to be there. That's the feeling I'm getting. Is that this is not where kids should come. We're not supposed to be here. And King's, and I'm walking around. I see money being exchanged. And then I see beyond the people, right there in the middle, there's some sand, and there are two roosters fighting and beating each other up. It was horrible. I had never seen that before. And they take them and put ice on them, stitch some, and throw them back to fight some more. And people are yelling and screaming. "Junior, let's go now." And we disappear. And now looking back, King was showing me hell. And one day we're having a pop soda and we're laughing and we had this ma and pop, you know, store where they sell everything, you know, and we're having a couple of colas and I started to tease him. We knew each other well. He teased me, but I got into this mean tease like cousins can do to one another. And King is like, "Para com isso, stop it." And I pushed it. And he looked at me very seriously. If you don't stop. And I looked at his fist. And I'm like, there's no way he's going to punch me. I'm his cousin. I sleep in the same bedroom with him. And I teased him a little bit more. And without saying a word, he punched me. Not across the face. He could have done that. Not in my stomach to knock me down. He could have done that. But ever so quickly and lightly, he threw one right into my heart. And he looked at me with his head like this, as if to say, this is not you. King was resetting my heart. Rest in peace, cousin. My monk. Thank you.
That was Antonio Rocha with My Monk. Antonio is reminded in that interaction with his cousin that it's all too easy to be careless in our treatment of other people in a way that can do damage we may not at first be able to see. So let's take care of each other, shall we? Let's be careful one with another. Has there been a time in your life when you've had to be a peacemaker? How did you do it? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, @byu.edu. We want to thank Motoko and Antonio Rocha for sharing their tales with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. Turn everyday moments into extraordinary nature adventures with the BYU Radio podcast, Constant Wonder Kids. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.